Welcome to the Hashtag Help podcast. My name is Subha and I'll be your host for this two-part series on refugee health. Over the last decade, refugee populations have been increasing significantly in Canada and worldwide. According to the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada, Canada accepted over 52,000 refugees in 2023 alone. So refugee health as a topic has become more and more relevant for community members, especially those working in the healthcare sector. Before we dive into the details of this series, it's important to understand, what is a refugee? According to the United Nations, a refugee is a person who is outside of their country of origin for reasons of feared persecution, conflict, generalized violence, or other circumstances that have seriously disturbed public order, and as a result, require international protection. There are several terms related to the concept of a refugee, but for this podcast, we'll be focusing less on the nuances of the terms and more on the expertise of someone who has dedicated a large part of their career to refugee and global health. On today's podcast, we'll have Dr. Allison Henderson joining us, who works with a team to run the Refugee Resettlement Clinic here in London, Ontario. Her experience with global and refugee health isn't just related to the essential work done in the clinic, which gets about 80 to 100 government-assisted refugees per month, but she's also had an interesting career path where she's been able to practice medicine all around the world. Dr. Henderson went to medical school here in London, Ontario at the Schulich School of Medicine at Western, then went to Vancouver to complete her residency in family medicine. She then pursued additional studies through the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK, then traveled to sub-Saharan Africa to practice as a physician in countries like Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia. At the Refugee Resettlement Clinic here in Ontario, she treats several refugee populations, including the Syrian, Yazidi, and Afghan refugees. Without further ado, we welcome Dr. Henderson onto the podcast. Thank you so much, Dr. Henderson, for being here. We're so happy to have you and to hear about your experiences.
Thanks for having me.
So first and foremost, we've gotten a little bit of a background into your experiences and your journey. What inspired you to pursue a career in global and refugee health?
Well, I came from a family that had worked in various places overseas. So my mother was actually born in Nigeria because her parents were working there. And my dad's family had come over as refugees after World War II, and then they had worked in Lesotho. So I had always grown up with stories about working in various places outside of Canada. And then we also came from a faith tradition where it was really important to think about how could you serve marginalized populations and how could you try to share some of these blessings and these gifts that you've been given just because of the family you've been born into with other people in the world. So I think it was sort of this, you know, childhood growing up, these themes that I heard often in my life that made me, first of all, consider medicine and then think about how can I work in global health or with refugees or with marginalized populations here in Canada.
That's really interesting. And I think a lot of people share similar values to that and can relate to that. The listeners have gotten a little bit of a background on your journey. So just for them, a little bit of advice, how can others get involved in the kind of work that you do?
Well, I think the most important thing is thinking about how you can get involved locally, wherever you are. So I know like when I went to med school, so this was in the mid-2000s. So I think I started med school in 2006. And there was sort of a group of us who were, we called it like globally health-minded. And so at that time, you were thinking, okay, working overseas, but then also how do we do this here? And I think I really realized during that time how important it is to be involved with marginalized populations in your own community. So when I was, I think it was just before starting med school, I'd gotten involved with a local youth group that was all newcomer youth, mostly from sub-Saharan Africa. And I actually did it with a group of my friends, and they were all sort of young teenagers, new to the country, and we ran social events, and we taught them, you know, how to write your G1 test, and, you know, what is a credit card, and don't spend too much money on it, and all these different sort of life skills. And we didn't really know what we were doing. We just wanted to be engaged and be sort of involved in our own communities. And that sort of changed my perspective going through med school about global health isn't just going somewhere, going overseas to help. It's about getting, digging down right in your community and trying to help, you know, solve some of these inequities and be present with marginalized groups right where you are.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point. A lot of the times when we think about global health and refugee health, it's always the international experience going abroad, helping. But I think that's really valuable to know that we can make a difference locally and kind of move forward from there. So you've had the unique experience of working in a variety of healthcare environments and with a really diverse range of populations. So can you give us some examples of places that you've worked, and how would you describe the context in contrast to the Canadian system and where you work now?
Sure. Yeah. So when I finished residency in family medicine, I went and did a diploma of hygiene and tropical medicine in East Africa. So it was through the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and John Hopkins. And we were based out of Tanzania and Uganda. And it was a really unique program because you had one third of the physicians were African physicians, one third were from the UK, and one third of us were sort of from all over the world. And we were in some of the big hospitals, like the biggest hospital in Kampala and one of the big hospitals in Moshi, Tanzania. And we were there as learners. So it was very different than when you, like, you know, you go and you start working right away and you maybe don't understand the language or the cultural context, and you're much more vulnerable really to making mistakes because you don't know what you're doing. But to go in as a learner in a program where you are learning from your colleagues, you're learning from other physicians who've worked in these environments, and then you're actually getting to discuss and talk about how these health systems are working. So I spent some time, as I said, in Tanzania and some time in Uganda. When I finished that, I worked for some NGOs in Tanzania, mostly in maternal child health, like public health. So it was really primary care, deworming, anemia, really sort of small scale but important interventions. And then from there, I moved to Zambia with my partner, who was originally from Zambia. And my plan had been sort of during med school, as I was saying, I was like, okay, from a global health perspective, it's not necessarily going to be me that needs to be seeing the patients or be being the physician. I'm not sure exactly what my role will be. And then when we got to Zambia, we were in the rural area close to the Congolese border. There was a refugee camps from Angola and from DRC. And hospital after hospital just didn't have a physician. Like, there was no physician in these areas. And the main reason really had to do with resources. Like, there was not schools there for your children to go to that provided strong enough quality of education. There wasn't regular power. So the living conditions, you know, were tricky. And then the pay is not good in a lot of countries when you're working as a physician. So it sort of changed my perspective. And I was like, oh, I could end up working clinically here because there is this need. So I went to Lusaka, which is the capital of Zambia, and I wrote the Zambian medical exam, just like everybody else who sits there. And I remember having to do sort of an OSCE-ish, you know, with professors, Zambian professors from the university, who I think were maybe slightly confused as to why I was there and why I was willing to be going out to some of these remote posts. And then I got posted to a hospital in northwestern Zambia on the Congolese border. And I went there and worked there for several months. So the first hospital I was at was originally a missions hospital, but they sort of transitioned, like the mission had been transitioning out. And so now it was all government employees, which is essentially what I was at that time, but unpaid. And it was difficult. I got there and there was a 60-bed hospital and I was the only physician. So it was very overwhelming. There was a great team. Like, I felt very supported by the nurses. We just didn't have a lot of resources. So we tried our best. We were able to have another Zambian physician join us later. And the transition plan was that I would stay on for a little bit while he came and help him get settled in because he was a new graduate. And then he would take over as the director of the hospital. So that was sort of one of my first clinical jobs working in Zambia. I worked at a government hospital for a while. The major challenges, again, were resources. So even if you had the skills, if you didn't have, you were out of 5% dextrose and you had children who were hypoglycemic from malaria, there wasn't a lot you were going to be able to do if they were having a seizure from hypoglycemia if you didn't have any sugar to give them. So I think that was something that really highlighted for me, you know, the logistics challenge is where a lot of the issues are. And so even if you have the clinical background and the clinical experience, if you don't have the tools that you need to take care of people, then your hands are a bit tied. From there, I moved on to a new mining hospital. A new copper mine was opening up in the area, and they had an insurance scheme for all of the miners. And so they were employing people from all the local villages who hadn't had that level of income before. So that was really exciting for the communities. And then their family members were able to join onto the insurance scheme. So for me, that was amazing because I was basically working with the same population. It was some of the same patients I'd been seeing at the government hospital, but now I had the logistics piece behind me because we had the resources of the mine. And the reason we had the resources is that the mine had many expats come in. And so they had to have their hospital at a certain standard, a certain level of care in order to have the families from Australia, Canada, South Africa, Zimbabwe feel comfortable to come and live in this remote area right on sort of the Zambian Congolese border. And the people who were in charge of the healthcare side of things really recognized at that time that they needed to be able to provide the same level of care to the local population. So it was one of those things of just being in the right place at the right time. We still struggled with like referrals out and when we had a case that we couldn't manage ourselves, because then we were kind of back into sort of the local public healthcare system where resources were short. But it was a lot more satisfying to work in, to be honest, because you could actually treat people properly for their malaria or their typhoid or, you know, their maternity care or their hypertension and their diabetes, things that like they may have not been able to get care for before.
Yeah, I can imagine seeing that transition of not being able to provide the proper care before and transitioning into a place where you actually can do that would be very rewarding. And to know the impact of the healthcare system of any country on the population. So I can imagine through your experiences, you must have learned a lot. So what are some big overarching lessons that you learned through your experiences?
For sure. To be honest, I think the number one thing is take care of your team. So you need to make sure that your staff are healthy, that they are having the emotional and sort of mental support in order to keep doing the work that they're doing, especially if it's challenging, especially if it's under-resourced. Because I think when you experience, and this can be in Canada too, right? Like just like you're saying, when you experience moral distress because you don't have the resources that your patient needs, or there's, you know, maybe it's more of the social determinants of health, like you can't get your patient housed, you know, that would be a problem that we would find here. If you feel like you're the only one carrying that burden, then it's a lot more difficult. But if you know you're on a team, it's sort of you're sharing that burden together, and you're also sort of accountable to each other. Like I might turn to my nurse, Amina, who you'll meet later, and say, oh, I wish there was more we could do here. And she might say to me, you've done everything you can do. Like you've tried hard, you know, it gives you just a little bit of, okay. And I think some of the other lessons are also understanding that, you know, someone said this to me once when I was having a hard time after a case that hadn't gone well, I need to take less credit for what goes well and less blame when things go badly. And that my influence isn't always as big as I think it is. And I think that's true for probably most of us in medicine as physicians, because, you know, we're trained in a way that tells us we are going to make a big difference and you need to know all your anatomy and your, you know, your neuro dermatomes and myotomes, because these things matter and they make a difference. And then you get out and you're practicing in the real world. And sometimes you're like, nothing I do makes a difference. And so it's kind of this dichotomy of learning, you know, at the end of the day, no matter where you're working or what, you know, if you're sitting across from a patient and they're from a different culture or a different race or a different language, one of the things that makes the most difference is seeing their humanity and being present with them and them knowing that you're fully listening and that you're fully trying to understand their situation and help them. I mean, obviously there's acute emergencies and traumas where you want to know your stuff. So I'm saying, you know, still do all that and study hard, but also know that a lot of these things are beyond us. So it's try your best, but take care of your team and then go to bed at night and know that you've done what you can.
Thank you for that. I think most of our listeners are medical students, so that's really reassuring and it really brings kind of a bigger picture to where we are in our lives. I speak for myself being in second year. So now I kind of want to shift to talking a little bit more about refugees and their experiences. I know there are a lot of different misconceptions about refugees and given where you work. I kind of wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about the refugee experience, what their journeys are like, given your interactions with them. Mm-hmm.
So just to set the stage a bit, so for the last 7 years now, I've been working in London, which is where, my hometown, where I'm from. And when we moved back to Canada, my family and I knew right away I want to do refugee health because it was sort of still connected to work that I had done before and things I had volunteered in. And I got lucky sort of falling into a job where someone had just retired. And London historically has not been a very multicultural city. And so one of the fears when my partner and I moved back to Canada was sort of like, oh, okay, we're going back to like a very monocultural city. And it was exciting to come back and find it not so much like that anymore. And part of that is because London receives so many refugees per capita. And so we started with a very small team with myself and a nurse and a nurse practitioner. And we've sort of grown over time to this bigger clinic that, you know, we're now sitting in today with other physicians who've joined us as well. And what we've seen in, so I'll just speak maybe to the 7 years that I've been here, because there's also physicians who've been doing this work before. One in particular would be Dr. Buma Bayana and Dr. Natalie Lovesey, who've been involved with refugee work in London. I remember as a med student working with Buma, and she was doing that work, you know, when I was just, you know, a small med student, like growing up. And so when I came, the Syrian wave was happening. And so, you know, that is a conflict I think that most people are aware of, a huge amount of displacement. And I think I was looking the other night, it's still 13 years into the conflict, you know, the highest output of refugees in the world. So that's very devastating. And so for, again, not to generalize, because every refugee has their own story. I think that's important to remember too, that you can't paint everyone with the same brush, and even from the same country, their journeys have been different. But you also, Syria was, you know, Damascus was a beautiful city. People were pharmacists and doctors and lawyers. And so you have a class of refugees who are well-educated and sort of middle class or upper class and used to a certain standard. And so it's very devastating for them to lose everything and to be terrified for their safety and then to come to Canada and start all over again. Like, I can think of one family I saw where they were a physician and a pharmacist couple in their sort of later years, and to be starting from scratch on Ontario Works and to not have a home and to be, you know, staying in the refugee shelter and then trying to figure out what they can do and not in their own language, you know, is really, really challenging. And then we've had different waves come through. So we also had a wave of Yazidi refugees from northern Iraq who'd been through horrific trauma with ISIS. The women and children had spent years in ISIS captivity. They'd been sold from man to man. The trauma wasn't like anything we'd seen before. And speaking to my colleagues across the country in refugee health, that was sort of the consensus. This was completely different than other refugee groups that we've seen because of the amount of trauma and the acuity and how quickly they were coming to Canada. I had some patients who'd gotten out of ISIS captivity a month or 2 months before arriving in my clinic. And they were young, some of them 14, 15, on their own. And so, you know, that was something that was really challenging for us in terms of vicarious trauma and also how to support this population with at the school and traumatized children. And then also at their ESL classes, sometimes the women were having psychogenic seizures because of triggers. And, you know, ESL is calling 911 because they think it's epilepsy. So there was lots of different conversations that had to happen in the city. It was really beautiful work to be partnering with all these different community organizations. And some of those patients, some of them now are doing quite well and functioning well. Some of them are still struggling, and some of them are still missing families in captivity. So you can imagine it's difficult to heal. And then we do get sort of a regular trickle of refugees from Somalia and DRC and Eritrea and Iraq and Rohingya refugees. And they all have sort of their individual stories. It is challenging when they get here. And I think we can talk more to that. But unfortunately, sometimes our healthcare system is talked about overseas as sort of the golden healthcare system, which we know here it's not. But when they come here, they're not expecting that. And so it's a big letdown. And even in terms of housing, like I had someone this week who just moved into an apartment and there's cockroaches in it. And she's devastated because she wasn't expecting to be dealing with that once she had, you know, come to the new country that she wanted to settle in. And it seems like maybe that's not a big deal because you're safe and no one's trying to kill you, but she doesn't feel welcome. She doesn't feel safe. She feels like she's still struggling and fighting to survive because She doesn't want to turn the lights out at night in her apartment because the cockroaches come out. So, it's not as easy for people to transition as we like to think.
Mm-hmm. And I think a common misconception that a lot of people have for refugees is that their problems are pretty much fixed after they relocate. Like, you're here now, so things must be great for you. They must be fine for you. But in reality, we know that there are, as you're speaking to some of the struggles that they face. So can you speak to some of the more social and psychological problems in resettling and kind of the culture shock that refugees face?
For sure. I think the number one thing would be being separated from extended family and sometimes immediate family. So, you know, a lot of our refugees come from cultures where they would be living in bigger family groups, or at least doing community in bigger family groups, like more so than we sort of traditionally do in the West, where we have our individual little family units. And so I've promised my patients, whenever I get a chance to speak about what their struggles are, the number one thing would be family reunification. So, you know, it's very difficult so let's say, for example, a Syrian woman who's here she's older, she's here with her two children who are 18 and 17, but she's left her older children because they were no longer sort of dependents, are still in Turkey. They're still in a refugee camp in Turkey. And let's say this is earlier this year, 2023. She's here. She's come with her two younger kids. They're safe. But the earthquake has just hit in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And she is terrified about what's happening with her older daughters who have their own children. So she's not well, right? Mm-hmm. She can't start to settle. She's not taking in anything at English class. She's wanting her daughters to be here and to be safe as well. So I would say that's like the number one barrier to settling, is when people know that their family members are still not safe. Another challenge would be sort of reorganization of the family unit. So oftentimes, especially parents with younger children, the younger children learn English much faster. And so there can be different situations where the child almost becomes the parent because they understand the language. And the adults, you know, whether it's the bank or whether maybe it's the clinic or the school, end up communicating with the child instead of the adult. And so you kind of remove that natural authority of the parent. Like, I think that's something that can be really destructive in a family that we always have to be mindful of when we're interacting with refugee families, whether it's in Emerge or in a clinic or, you know, out in the community. And then I think that, like we're seeing in Canadian society in general, inflation and cost of living and difficulty getting housing and inadequately housed and struggling with food security. These are all sort of issues that we see our families. We've had families end up in shelters after their 1 year of refugee, you know, payments run out because they can't afford their rent anymore when they're on Ontario Works and they're not able to get a job yet. And then we face issues with stigma and racism and Islamophobia. And, you know, I think living in London, we're all very aware that we have a problem with that. And so I can't even imagine what it feels like to come as a Muslim refugee to a city where, you know, a family was killed because they were Muslim. Like, I can't imagine that is something that, you know, is going to be help you with your journey in terms of your emotional and your mental stability. So I think there's lots of positives as well. Like, I think I've some of the schools I've worked with, the work they're doing is very impressive in terms of how they're, you know, teaching children and supporting their families and helping to integrate them. And I think we've got some really great community organizations like LUSO and CCLC and the Southwest Library, who have settlement workers who are doing great work. But I do think our families do continue to experience hardships and trauma after arrival that makes it harder for them to move forward in the ways that we typically measure in settlement, like language and employment and housing, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. You've touched on some of the resources here in London. I wanted to talk about the fact that here in London, we accept the third highest populations of refugees in Canada. So in your opinion and your expertise, are existing resources enough to support the refugees in resettling successfully into society?
So this is something we've talked about at our clinic, and the answer is definitely no. And we have talked before with different politicians when we've had a chance. The targets are set federally and it's the federal government that sort of decides where people go. And my understanding is that there's transfer payments made to the province, in particular with regards to health, for refugees, but that doesn't necessarily follow the patient or trickle down to the day-to-day reality of caring for refugee families. So I think we have a long way to go in terms of making sure that we have the resources to support refugees that are coming. And we do know that government-assisted refugees, which is a lot of the patients that we see here at the clinic, are UNHCR refugees who've been designated for resettlement because of the highest need. And that sometimes is trauma, sometimes that is physical needs, medical needs, safety needs. So these are our individuals who are very resilient because they've made it this far, but they also need some resources behind them in order for them to succeed. And so we need to do a better job of following the resources with the refugees as they come.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned talking to the government. So we know that on a global scale, the refugee numbers are always changing. So reflecting those changes, what kind of policies are being implemented here in Canada that you know of?
So I think that what's challenging about refugee health policy too is that it can change as the immigration minister changes, and it can change as the party, the Liberal Party or the Conservative, you know, whoever's in power, things can shift. So we did have the opportunity earlier this fall to meet with Mark Miller, the new immigration minister, and he did highlight Canada's continued commitment to refugee resettlement. And we are in terms of resettlement. So Canada is, I think for the last 3 years, has taken the most number of resettled refugees, resettled GARs, of any country in the world. That's different than, you know, a country like Turkey or Uganda that hosts, or Lebanon, who hosts like 1 million, 2 million refugees. We're bringing in like 50,000, like much, much smaller amounts. But in terms of, I guess, the response from the developed world, we are one of the countries that does take more refugees. So that's positive. I want to acknowledge that, but also say that it's such a drop in the bucket when you think about the actual numbers, right? Like, I think they're saying like 109 displaced people. The UNHCR said like the highest it's ever been, 109 million displaced people. And that's before we're talking about, you know, currently what's going on with Palestine, and we don't know what will happen there, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking huge, huge numbers. And a country like Turkey or Uganda and Lebanon are hosting many, many more refugees than we are. The policies, yeah, I mean, it's tricky because I think we're, as I said, it's the federal government with the numbers, and then it's on a much more local number, a local level, that we need resources and approaches and policies. I do know, like, the City of London has started having working groups around refugee claimants, because we're also getting more and more asylum seekers coming to our city. So I think there is a push right now on a local level to start thinking about how can we be strategic about this in a way that can help people to thrive and to function and to, quote unquote, become contributing members of society sort of as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that you highlighted that it's not enough. Things are happening, but it's not enough, because I think maybe in the general population, it's kind of this notion of like, okay, yeah, of course, we're Canada, like, we keep accepting refugees, and people might be for that, might be opposed to that. So I think it's really important that somebody like you, who's interacting with these populations, is acknowledging that it's not enough.
So far, we've talked a bit about the refugee experience and Dr. Henderson's personal expertise. We'll continue hearing from Dr. Henderson in the second part of the series, where she'll talk about practical tips for approaching refugee healthcare in clinical settings. So don't forget to listen to our next episode. For the rest of this episode, I'd like to introduce Amina, a nurse working at the Refugee Resettlement Clinic, who shares her experience working with refugees.
So my name's Amina. I'm a nurse that works at the Resettlement Refugee Health Clinic. I've been with them since 2015, where we had the Syrian influx of refugees. I came to Canada as a refugee myself. I was less than a year old when I came here, so don't have too many memories of what happened. I was born in a refugee camp, so this work is very important to me, and I'm grateful to be here.
We're grateful to have you here. In terms of your work as a nurse and interacting with refugee populations, Dr. Henderson and I talked a little bit about the challenges that they face when they're here. Could you maybe speak to some success stories that you've come across or some of the characteristics that make refugees more likely to have successful resettlement when they come here?
So like Dr. Henderson mentioned, we are receiving the most resilient people here because they survived war, they survived trauma, and they came here and they're still functioning. They're still trying to live. They're still hopeful. So I think that helps a lot, that we do have a lot of people who came as refugees and then maybe they ended up helping at the Cross-Cultural Learners Center as a life skill worker to help new refugees resettle and help share their stories and help share the resources around London and kind of navigate them and help them in that way. We have people that became interpreters as well. So they used to be our clients, but had learned the language and now they're able to interpret for the new set of refugees that we see. So we're working with people that have so much potential and they are so resilient and they're contributing so much in various different ways, whether that is within the clinic itself or they're going to school. We see that we have a lot of clients come in wanting to complete like school forms for immunizations, TB skin tests and all of that because they want to go into a professional program and become nurses or social workers or doctors themselves. So we have a population that is ready to give their all despite everything that was, you know, taken from them. They still have this drive and this love to serve, and we see that very clearly with the populations that we have here.
Thank you so much for that.
That concludes part one of our two-part refugee health series. We hope this episode was able to give some more insight into the refugee experience and refugee health as a whole. Be sure to listen to part two of the series, where we'll be hearing helpful tips and practical advice from Dr. Henderson on how to approach refugee health for those working in healthcare or interacting with refugees.